Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking about lots of things relating to technology. We're going to zero in a bit on dual-factor authentication to start the show with our guest, Jesse LeGrue, back with us once again. He's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Always great to have him come by. And certainly if you have questions about two-step verification, maybe you have a tech problem with your computer, your phone, love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jesse LeGrue, welcome back.
Thanks.
Good to have you with us again. Well, I kind of like dual-factor authentication, but there may be people who aren't familiar with it, so just what is it to begin with?
So there's a few different pieces kind of rolling around. You might hear two-factor authentication, dual-factor authentication,
yeah,
or multi-factor authentication. What most of us are used to is you enter a password, you kind of get access to your variety of services. And really what these types of technologies are trying to do is have additional proof that you are who you say you are so you can get access to your services, really protecting whatever service you're using from somebody else getting access to it. And they usually do it in a variety of ways. One is by proving you are who you are from what you know. In this case, it might be a password, something you have, which could be a cell phone or an application or some other type of device, or it could also be by something you are, which could be like a biometric, mm-hmm, including a thumbprint, an iris scan, or something else. Facial recognition is often used. So two-factor or dual-factor is trying to use two different ways of verifying who you are before you can get access, mm-hmm, to a resource. So even if somebody knows your password, for example, they can't access what you might want to protect without also having a code that could be on your, mm-hmm, phone or something else. So it's really an extra protection to validate who is accessing some kind of system.
And, you know, for financial purposes, I know most of the or many of the banks, probably all of them, and the credit unions are using some form of it.
Yeah, a lot of banks are rolling that out or have already rolled it out. Many just require it.
Yeah.
So if you are going to access something online, you need to have some kind of second factor of authentication, whether it's a smartphone application, an SMS or a text message or something else. So it dramatically increases your security because people can't just break in with a password. They have to have some other method to also, you know, circumvent the system and try to make the system believe they are you rather than who they are.
Now, when I've had it done or done it, it was because, you know, like the financial institution gave me the directions. Could you set up your own device?
A lot of times you can. Most services these days will have that as an option. So usually a password is something, you know, email or username and a password is how you access a variety of systems. Most of the time, there is a second factor of authentication available. You know, Google does this, Facebook does this,
yeah,
and you can use a different factor in addition to just a password to increase the security of your account. Many times it's not required, but I highly recommend it for anyone that is using any kind of service to enable multi-factor authentication because it makes it that much more difficult for somebody to be able to break into your account and get access to your information.
So we can set it up on the user's end if we want to.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
There might be some services that don't have that as a capability, but those, I think, are shrinking and are much more rare. I would probably question the service I'm utilizing. If it doesn't offer,
yeah,
that is an option.
So can you still be hacked with this kind of system? I'm trying to think of different risks that might be posed.
There are still risks. I think you always see it in spy movies. where all these crazy things happen and they, you know, could access your fingerprints. And there's always a risk regardless of kind of what you're using. What we're trying to do by having this second factor is making it increasingly difficult to be able to break in. So while there's a risk, it's at least still protecting you a lot more than what you had in the past. One item for multi-factor authentication, you know, you can use a smartphone app, which I think is one of the easiest ways to interact with one of these different kinds of systems. You can use an application, or you can even use a text message. The text message is generally not recommended because some people can use SIM swapping or other methods to break into your phone that would compromise that different method. So I would always say using an application is beneficial. You can also purchase third-party devices that have a code that, without having that physical device, it can't be transferred to anything else. There is just no way to access the system. It does raise other questions in terms of the availability of those services. So if you don't have that code, you might not be able to access what you're trying to access. If you don't have the internet, what does that mean in terms of being able to use the service too? So there's a lot of different considerations when using multi-factor. Granted, if you don't have internet access in order to get a code, you're probably not accessing Facebook anyway. So there's less of an issue there, but it could be a concern with specific types of services.
Yeah, I would think if you couldn't provide the second part, you're kind of could be kind of out of luck almost, wouldn't you? Or is there a way around it or what?
Yeah, and some of the what a lot of applications will do. So some of the applications I really like for the second factor, most times when you log into a site and you have multi-factor or two-factor, you know, dual factor enabled, you might have to type in a six-digit code or something else that you have from an app or a special key that might be separate. One of the items I like is actually getting a prompt through the app, which I have to approve or deny. Mm. And there's a couple reasons for it. One, I mean, it does require I have internet connectivity, but it also tells me if somebody actually managed to guess or break into my password, I literally have a real-time prompt that if I didn't access the service, it tells me there's, you know, somebody probably got through the first gate and they might be trying to get through the second gate. So I kind of like that because it gives me an idea that my account might be compromised. But let's say I was offline. A lot of those applications also have a code generation failback. So if I'm not online, they have a code option that I can type in a generated code, and it's paired with my device and my application. So it proves I am who I say I am, at least ideally. But you have a backup mechanism. So if you don't have the internet, you can still get in. But I do like those prompts because it's really nice when somebody, if somebody tells me, I got a prompt and I didn't log into something, should I be concerned? You know, if you got the prompt and you didn't log into anything, someone else did. And that's an indication that somebody probably has your password and you should go ahead and reset that.
Our guest today, Jesse LeGrew, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Always great to have him come by and talk with us. Questions for him maybe about dual-factor authentication, or maybe you just have another computer or software issue that you want to talk about, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Chris emailed that she tried to free up Dropbox space by dragging a folder, a Finder window to Finder window, into iCloud. Now the folder does not appear in Dropbox, but the iCloud folder is empty. The folder does, however, still exist when she logs into Dropbox. How can she get the folder to show up as a Dropbox folder in her Finder again?
So this sounds like there might be a couple issues.
Yeah.
So it definitely looks like the Dropbox application that's on the Mac and the web interface for Dropbox are out of sync, because normally what you're going to see on Finder on your Mac is going to match what you see on Dropbox on a web interface. The one scary thing about this is on the Mac, you don't see it in iCloud and you don't see it in Dropbox. But it is on the Dropbox web app, which means the data at least can be seen within Dropbox. I'd highly recommend downloading all that data on Dropbox somewhere just as a safekeeping. Usually Dropbox does have a recycling bin. So even if you delete something, you can still restore it within a certain amount of time. I would just be concerned with losing the data. I would actually look to log out and log back into the Dropbox application on the Mac, which might resynchronize all the data. The risk with that is it could go one of two ways, where it says, hey, the Mac is the most updated, I should delete this stuff on Dropbox, or it'll go the other way, which is Dropbox has this data that should be on the Mac, and it'll download the data again.
So you want to copy that first.
I would be extra paranoid. I'd go to the web interface, click on the you normally have a box on the left, and you can highlight all those files and folders, and just download all of it to be completely safe. Then go ahead, log off, log back into the application, and have it sync. That might be the same thing with iCloud as well. You could log off of iCloud and log back in. But they also have synchronization settings for iCloud in addition to Dropbox, where you can turn or turn off that feature. So it could be that iCloud simply doesn't have that check mark to synchronize not only like contacts and mail or other favorites like Safari, but it could not be synchronizing that data as well. So I would check the settings and system preferences just to see what that looks like and see what's enabled. But for the Dropbox thing, I would I would definitely log off and log back into the app. But to be extra cautious, I would go to that web interface where you see all of that data and download it locally just in case you run into anything weird.
Jesse LeGru, our guest with Madison College's Technology Services Group. Questions for him? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We are ready to take your questions. I'm Larry Mueller. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. And you're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your technology today, your phones, your computers, and your software with our guest, Jesse LeGru from Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Steve emailed an interesting question to ask if it's possible to play two apps at one time. For instance, a listen to WPR and music at the same time. He says he can download a game and play that at the same time he listens to music, but not when he's listening to WPR. And I have no idea. Jesse, do you have some thoughts on that?
There are a few thoughts. Many times when you have multiple applications, they're kind of competing for certain resources. In this case, it might be competing for the speaker or whatever you're listening to. So the game probably has audio. WPR probably has audio. And depending on the mobile device, whether it's an iPhone or Android or even a Windows mobile, they probably have different settings. And I was trying to take a look a little bit at kind of the Android. You might have the capability of picking one audio or the other, but you might have to install a third-party application. So it could be they're competing, and you might have to pick one or the other. One of the items that I would probably recommend is, whether it's expected or not, to kind of reach out, one, probably directly to WPR in terms of feedback for the app, or potentially even the maker of the game, because it could also be a feature request if it's not currently capable by the application. It's likely a limitation or a setting change on the device itself, whether it's an iPhone or an Android. They're just competing for sound. One of them wants to win, and we kind of get used to the devices that we use on a day-to-day basis, because you can have sound in your browser, you can have sound in the system, and you can have Hulu, Netflix, all sorts of other stuff running. And usually you kind of pick one sound. Most desktops will actually just mesh them all together. Mobile devices tend to be a little bit more picky and choosy, especially for iPhones, because they want to keep the platform secure, so they don't want the applications necessarily interacting with each other or running really simultaneously overlapping. And while they do have ways to segregate that information, they might choose to only pick one sound or one display at one time, potentially for security reasons, but also to minimize some confusion.
Interesting. Well, boy, our listeners are kind of quiet today. No calls in. You can join in right now at 1-800-642-1234 or email us. We got some emails here at ideas@wpr.org. If you've got a problem or a question about any of your technology, we'd love to hear from you. Again, 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Are you seeing, it won't be long and we're going to be into the holiday season where a lot of things are going to get purchased, a lot of new things. And anything on the horizon that you'd like to have in your stocking or something for the kids?
That's actually interesting. The thing I want the most right now is actually some working thermostats. I had an issue with one shorting out, so I actually need to replace that. And I've been considering kind of which way to go, whether with a smart thermostat or with a more traditional offline thermostat. So I think for me, I'm getting an offline thermostat that doesn't have a lot of the bells and whistles, because there have been a lot of concerns with devices that just have things like microphones or other items you're not anticipating. So for me, I just have a normal plain old thermostat I'm looking for.
Well, I tell you what, I've got a friend who said she was out in California and she'd forgotten to turn down her thermostat, and so she just did it with her phone. And she checks the temperature of the house and so forth while she's away. And I wondered, could somebody hack into something like that?
And I think that's the concern with a lot of devices out there right now, is the potential exists. So if you have anything on the internet, including wireless is even a little bit more dangerous because you don't need physical access. There are other mechanisms to break into it, especially if you're in the neighborhood. So it can be kind of risky, but it's also really, really nice to be able to check, is it hot? Is it cold? If you're out for 2 weeks and you want to make sure that, it's winter at home and things get really cold, do you see that thermostat? We're going to say, I know it's 60 degrees in the house. I know pipes aren't going to freeze. So there's, it's always a balance.
Yeah.
But it is a possibility, which is why it's always good to look at all the details of any device you purchase. Does it have something I necessarily don't want in it? And to actually review the boring things no one really wants to do, which is the privacy policies and the terms of service for anything that you're actually using at home. No one wants to do that.
No.
Because it's a lot of information to read. But you can also get a good indication usually from the specifications of the device. Does it come with a microphone? Does it come with a camera? Am I concerned with what it might be doing? I recently bought a TV, and it has a microphone built in. I actually didn't realize that, but it was one of those things when I was looking through the settings. I'm like, oh, it has a microphone. That's interesting. I'm going to turn that off because I don't plan on using it, but I also don't want anything listening if...
Right.
I just don't want it to. It's something that I don't anticipate to use, and it's like anything we buy, turn off the things you're not going to use because they can do weird things.
Let's take some calls. Katie in Janesville will give you a chance. Thanks for calling, Katie.
Hi, good day. I have a computer that is about 8-9 years old. It runs Windows 7 when it decides it wants to run. And in today's world, it's a dinosaur, and we totally get that. Right now, it is starting to freeze up on us, and we're having a hard time accessing it. What would be the very best type of configuration I would need? I know at work, I'm getting used to Windows 10, but for a family, gaming, that type of thing, I have a lot of hunters. They like to use their game cameras, be able to access things remotely, that sort of thing. Going forward, what would be the best configuration of a computer to be looking for?
Mm-hmm. One of the considerations in this case, so for most webcams or anything like that, probably any device is going to work fine. Usually it's just accessing through a web browser, so I don't think there's any unique challenges there. One item that would be of interest is, do you have any specialty applications or programs that you run or that you would anticipate? And let's say throw games or anything in there as well. Is there anything you know people would be using the computer for?
Gaming would be one thing.
Okay. Okay.
I have teenagers and young adults.
Oh, okay.
So there's a couple items there. And part of it, I'd actually probably look for a few games that they'd be interested in playing and see what platforms they run on. Because they may run on Windows devices, they may run on macOS devices, or they might be actually browser-based, which increasingly a lot of games are.
Yeah.
I would probably be leaning towards a Windows computer, especially for gaming, because there just tends to be more games available for Windows-based computers. In terms of power, I think that's where the games are going to have an impact as well.
Right.
Because most likely games are going to have higher requirements for video performance that, Office, a lot of other general day-to-day applications are really not going to need. And I think those are going to work fine on whether you have a Chromebook, whether you have an Apple computer, or whether you have a PC with Windows. Based on kind of at least what I'm hearing, I'd probably be leaning towards Windows computer, but I would actually look at the games that they'd probably end up playing and see what devices are supported. I have a feeling it's going to close in on those requirements, and you're probably going to make a decision based on that. You can really run the gamut in terms of what possible configurations you can have. But I think for most things, you can spend less than $1,000 on a really good computer that will do most of what you're looking for.
Yeah. Are there power or memory considerations and all that sort of thing?
Yeah. And for most computers these days, I would normally look at like a Core i5 or mid-range processor with at least 8 gigabytes of memory, if not more. I'd probably even recommend 16 gigabytes of memory.
Yeah.
And if you're running games and a lot of other things at the same time, you might even want to increase that, and it could be a pretty negligible cost. I would always recommend a solid-state hard drive because that will improve performance dramatically. Having more memory will improve performance as well. The other thing is, are the things you plan on running, are they supported? If you have a lot of applications that run only on Windows computers, get a Windows computer.
Right.
That also goes the other way around. If you have programs you're running that only run on Mac, you might want a Mac. I have a feeling running a Windows 10 computer would probably be easiest based on what you're currently using, which is Windows-based computers, and would probably give you the most amount of flexibility in terms of gaming and other applications. And you really do have a lot more flexibility in terms of what kind of processor do you want? How much memory do you want? How much storage do you want? You just get a lot more flexibility from the range of vendors that sell personal computers or Windows-based PCs.
There you go, Katie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Carrie in Balsam Lake, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my question. I live in the country, and my only choice for a provider for satellite is CenturyLink.
Okay.
And for my email. And whenever I open my emails from their site, a page pops up that says your connection is not private. Attackers might be trying to steal your information from mail.centurylink.net. And I've called in the past to CenturyLink, and they have assured me it's not a problem on their end. It's something else. And what do you recommend I do?
And for the web, do you have a specific web browser that you're using to access your email through CenturyLink?
Well, I have a Chrome tablet, so I don't know what it is to tell you the truth.
Yeah, it's probably the built-in web or the Chrome web browser.
Yep. That'd be my guess. Okay. So you could try another browser.
Yeah, I would try another browser just to take a look. It kind of depends on, do you get the pop-up message on any other websites, or have you noticed it before, or is it only on this webmail?
It's only on the CenturyLink emails, because I have a Gmail as well. So, and it's been going on for a while, and I do have a security program that I have received word from there that my email has been hacked and I need to change all my passwords. But I'm in the middle of doing that. But I no longer trust CenturyLink. So I'm wondering, can I just change everything to my Gmail and just get rid of my CenturyLink password? I mean, email.
And that's definitely a possibility as well. The biggest challenge with that would just be notifying the individuals or updating any profiles for any services that you use to use your Gmail address rather than your CenturyLink account. So, you know, moving addresses is definitely a possibility. It's just knowing who's currently using your CenturyLink address that you just need to say, hey, by the way, I'm not going to be checking this. Please use this new address instead, and kind of redirect all communications that way. You might be able to have CenturyLink actually delete the email address, meaning that even if it is compromised, no one can utilize it to send email that might look like it's coming from you, or, you know, otherwise compromise kind of what you're using it for. So it is possible. It might take a little bit of work. One item I'd actually recommend as well, if you are accessing the CenturyLink email, is just take a look at the URL that you're accessing the web email from. Usually for any website you visit that is secure, like Gmail, you'll notice in the upper left-hand corner, usually you're going to see a lock or something that's telling you that the website is secure. If you're using the wrong link, or it was a link that was previously kind of migrated away from, you might get a message noting that it's insecure. And it's not because the site's insecure, but it's because you're accessing a location or a link that isn't properly addressed by their security. So just make sure that the link you're accessing the email in your web browser from is the latest documented link. I did try to access just the webmail interface, and it said, hey, you might have a security risk, but it's not because the website's insecure. It's because it's actually pointing to webmail.centurylink.net, not mail.centurylink.net. So I would just verify the link you're accessing is the latest one. Then you'll at least notice if there's kind of a behavior change, but it could be you're actually just using an outdated link. That's why you're getting the messages. And the certificate they have to secure all your traffic just doesn't match. So verify the link, try that. But if you actually are concerned with the account itself and want to move away, just notify the people that you have that you're not going to be checking the account. And if you can, actually ask CenturyLink to see if they can completely delete the account so no one can actually get into it and do something that you wouldn't want them to.
There you go, Carrie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mary in Chippewa Falls, your turn now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I'm wondering, I got an external hard drive, and I plug it in, and it flashes, a couple flashes. How can I tell if it's really working?
Have you, has it worked in the past? Are you concerned it's broken?
No, if I just bought it, and they set it up for automatic updates or automatic backup at a certain time of the week.
Okay. Do you know what program or how they configured it to work?
No.
Okay.
Just that it goes on at 1 o'clock on a certain night.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a Windows computer or an Apple computer?
I have a Windows with 10, Windows Microsoft 10 on it.
Yeah.
The Windows 10. Yeah.
Okay, so this may or may not help. If you go to, you know, My Computer or the File Explorer, you'll see the variety of, you know, computer drives that you have on your system. Usually your C drive, for example, is your main computer where all your files and Windows is located. And you'll also have different ones, one of which might be that external hard drive. Have you looked there to see if it at least appears?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
That's probably where I'd check first, because normally for any external hard drive, when you plug it in, it will show up as a different drive letter. So just as a flash drive might show up in Explorer or my computer, an external hard drive will show up the same way. That being said, the external hard drive, they can make it work in a way where you can't interact with it, and Windows itself is doing a lot of stuff in the background that you might not be aware of. I would contact who actually set it up to ask what program they used to configure it, and then kind of go from there. Because most of the programs, whether it's built into Windows or it's made from that hard drive manufacturer itself, you can actually open up the application and it will tell you, we last ran a backup. It took this long. It backed up this many files. And it will actually tell you whether it's working or not. You just need to know where to find it. And I could tell you a lot of places, but they might be different based on your situation. So I look at Windows Backup Utility because that's built in and they might have used that. But if you do have a hard drive, look for a program on your computer that fits the name of that manufacturer. So for example, if it was a Western Digital hard drive, look for a Western Digital application on your computer that might have the backup application you're looking for. But I would look for Windows Backup or look for your manufacturer backup program. The best thing to do is probably to just contact who helped set it up. Ask them how they set it up so you have that documentation for yourself. If you did have an invoice, hopefully it's in those invoice notes because usually they'll have information about what they did for your computer, but you might need to contact them anyway just to verify. It's probably going to be quicker for you rather than you just digging through the system.
And thanks, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. Ron in Osceola, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hey, good morning. Question for you. I'm a big Packer fan. How complicated is it to set up my radio so I can listen to the radio announcers rather than the TV announcers?
Yeah, so there's a delay, or the radio might be ahead. Sometimes they're ahead, sometimes they're behind, I think. Depends on your what you've got for a video or a provider.
That is a really, really good question. I don't have an answer for this one. There are a lot of ways you can watch TV, and you can change kind of where it's playing. But I think it's going to be kind of a challenge to actually match the audio from a different source with what you have on the TV, because you're competing with a few different things there, including delays, one based on the radio station, but also delays based on the TV broadcast. And even if you match it at one point, over time it might change again based on commercials and everything else. So I don't have an easy answer for this one. I can think of a lot of ways to try to work around it, but even if you manage to match it at one point in time,
it's gonna
half
change.
An hour later it could change. And I'll think about it a little bit, but I don't think I can
come up with
recommend
something.
One easy way to do that.
And the services, Jay, you know, I was thinking about talking on the phone with my father-in-law who's in Watertown, Wisconsin, and I'm in Madison, and we've got the Brewers game on, and he says, oh, nice hit, you know, and I'm saying, and then I said, what hit? Oh, there it is. So it was a several second delay between my service and his service.
Yeah. The other thing, if you do have a radio station that you normally like to listen to, you might even want to inquire with the radio station how they actually are viewing the broadcast, because they could view it in person or remote. And if you can find the same way they're viewing it, you could try to duplicate that experience. Because if they're in the game, that's different than if they're watching it remotely via a TV station. Because then maybe you can just watch it the same way they are. But it always depends on how they're consuming it.
It's tricky. Thanks, Ron. It's a question that a lot of people have had, I'm sure. Kim in Whitehall, your turn. Hi, Kim.
Good morning. I have a Google Pixel XL2. My wife and I have matching phones. And suddenly the fingerprint scanner stopped working on the back of mine. So I went into the menu to try and reset it. That option has disappeared from the menu as well. My wife still has it on her menu. Hers works fine, but I've looked and looked. There's nothing there. I can't reset it. It doesn't exist. I contacted Google customer support. They had me try a number of things, including a factory hard reset, which was a nightmare, having to rebuild my phone again, to no effect. I still don't have a fingerprint scanner, and I don't know what else to look at.
Did you both have the same model device, or are they different model devices?
Nope, they're exactly the same phones. We bought them at the same time.
Did you check to see if you have different software versions?
Different software versions for?
For the operating system on the phone. Often Google and other manufacturers will release updates, whether they're feature releases or security releases, kind of on regular intervals. So I'm kind of curious whether one of the phones got updated and the other one didn't.
Oh, yeah. That's a possibility.
I haven't checked her updates. I always, every time an update comes in for security or whatever, I allow it to go through. I'd have to check and see if she's been doing the same.
I would probably recommend checking that to see if they are different. If they're the same, it's a little bit more confusing. My guess is that they're at different software versions, and either a software version, you know, changed the availability of that feature, and you could potentially either upgrade or downgrade the phone to a different software version based upon what you find out. But that's where I'd probably look next, because what you're going to want to find out, what's the differences between the two devices? They're the same model. The factory reset didn't change anything. I really would look at the software versions to see if they are different. Granted, if they are the same software versions and you do not have the option, even after the factory reset, the only thing I could recommend is potentially going into a store to actually watch them factory reset a different phone. But it's going to be kind of a lot of troubleshooting. I would check the software versions and kind of go from there.
Yeah, that's the simple, straightforward first step. A listener emailed that a friend frequently sends numerous photos of their family, and there are now thousands of them in her For You folder on her iPhone, and she wants to know how to delete them.
And it definitely depends on what application you're using on the iPhone. And was this built into the iPhone? It was a For You folder?
Yeah.
It could be a shared folder that you have between the two of you. Which you might be able to either kind of not really unsubscribe, but sometimes you can like unshare yourself from looking at the information, and that'll at least clear it up. But you might also need to ask your friend to kind of disconnect you from that folder, which will make it disappear as well. In the end, I think they're still storing all of that data. You just happen to be kind of listed as a consumer. It happens a lot in Facebook where you kind of get tied to a thread and you end up having access to a lot of stuff you really don't necessarily want, which can happen a lot with conversations. So I would see if your friend could potentially disconnect it, and then you wouldn't have access to it.
Grant emailed that his internet-only access provider just raised the monthly bill to about $75 a month. So what's the best method for finding another internet-only access provider at a lower cost?
In this case, the only thing I can recommend is basically just shop around, ask people around your neighborhood what they're using, because some internet service providers are very they're restricted to certain areas because of infrastructure. For example, there's a lot of companies that do fiber internet service, which allows for direct connections that are much, much faster, potentially cheaper, but it depends on that being available in the area. So I'd really shop around and ask for input from neighbors because it can be so based on location. But even the traditional services aren't the only way you have to go. There, in many cases, is like neighborhood Wi-Fi or certain providers that will make that available, kind of like a city wireless. Or there are cellular services that you can take advantage of. If you have a cell phone plan Depending on how much internet you use, that could be a different option as well. But you kind of have to know also, one, where you're living, so what's available. Two, how much internet do you plan on using in a month? If you don't use a whole lot, you might be able to use your cell phone plan with little to no increase and actually be basically free. I think most users are streaming TV and other services, so it's probably not going to be a very great option. But if you only do basic web browsing, it could be. So chat with your neighbors, find out what's available, but it could be very location-specific.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at your computer and your phone and all kinds of technology issues today with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, information security architect at Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Lots of callers online. I think we'll just go right back to the phones. And Jacob in Madison, thanks for waiting.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just I called with one question in mind, but in the meantime, another question has occurred to me. So you, I don't know if you'd want to take two, but one is that I'm kind of concerned about a lot of friends of mine. Two of them in particular have Alexas in their bedrooms right next to their beds. And do Alexas, they hear what's going on, and someone else told me that they also can film things. So I wondered if you could address that. And the other question I had is if you could inform people, including me, about the 5G networks that are coming out. And I did see a program on the internet that was, it was a film that was over an hour long that was describing that it was hundreds of times more powerful than 4G, and how hyper-connected everything is going to be now that it's actually rather scary.
Yeah.
So I wondered if you could address that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Jacob.
Yeah, so I'll tackle the Alexa one pretty quick. So like any device that has a microphone or a camera built in, is the possibility that it could be recording audio or video either without your consent or somehow being shipped somewhere. Technically, it's possible. If the device is compromised, for example, even somebody outside of the company that helps to make that technology, you know, they could find ways to use it. Same thing for a laptop computer that might have a camera built in and a microphone, which most do. There are ways to compromise and use that to do things that aren't intended. Most companies are doing with a lot of those is they have action words that enable the device to do something at a certain time. So it limits that overall risk. But it is a possibility that if there is a camera installed, could it be looking for something or recording? It's a technical possibility. I would not state that is currently being done just by how it comes from the factory, but it's an additional risk. And I'd say for anyone that brings any technology into their home, you can find ways to safeguard it, whether it's people like Post-it notes quite a bit to cover up cameras or find ways to limit sound. And I know there are actually products out there that try that you can put on top of devices that will actually offer a different filter. So no sound can pass through until a certain action is taken or a certain word is used. The downside is that filter you're putting in between is kind of a similar risk that you already have with the device originally. You're trusting another device to filter that through. So it's always a risk. But you can find ways to kind of work around that. If you're really concerned, put a box over it. No one can see it. And that helps a little bit.
5G networks.
5G. So once again, I am not a doctor. I'm not a medical doctor or a doctor of any way, shape, or form. There is a lot of conversation around 5G and whether it could have health impacts. Are there greater intensities of transmissions being used? Yes, there are. With any technology that's out there, there's always some kind of risk. The conversation is actually really still ongoing. They've even kind of stated, we really don't know until we kind of have more to study from, which is kind of the challenge of We don't know what the impact's going to be until we start doing something that actually creates the impact. So you can't study it until it's actually out there. And a lot of people are really concerned. I can't really answer the question.
Yeah.
There are some risks out there with anything. From even some of the research that I've read, it always depends on the type of frequencies being utilized and where those fit in the spectrum. One of the comments that I also saw was that you're getting more exposure from simply going out into the sunlight than you are from what this technology could provide. So in terms of risk, it's actually riskier just simply going outside to be exposed to sunlight. Granted, you know, that's simplistic and there's a lot of other complicating factors in there. But it's a potential risk, but I don't think it's one that people are stating this is going to
drastically change things.
Drastically change things. But hindsight's also 20/20. There have been a lot of comments similar in the past that we've noted, hey, this is completely safe. And then we look 20, 30 years later, well, it turns out.
Yeah.
So I'm not stating that this is something that's safe or not. But, you know, we're going to find out in the future how that goes. And we'll have more information.
Betty in Dodgeville, it's your turn. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, my question is, I used to religiously delete all my email messages, both my sent and drafts and in-mail, but now I just let them keep filling up the box, so to speak, and just save the ones I want to save. Is that dangerous?
It definitely can be, and I think it's one of the things that's so easy to do nowadays because storage is basically unlimited.
Yeah.
We really don't think about cleaning up files, emails, or anything else. Just like anything that you might have in a house that simply collects data or things, there's an increased risk because, one, you're quite not really sure what's in there anymore. And that has additional risk where you might have sensitive data that you might not think about that you should be concerned with, and it's actually easier to just get rid of it. So I would always state, if you don't need it, delete it. One, it just helps with your own peace of mind of actually knowing what's in your inbox. If somebody happens to get in there, you could have 20 years of data that, you know, even looking 20 years ago, it might not have been sensitive, but now over time it becomes a little bit more sensitive. So I'd recommend definitely cleaning it out when you can. It can take a lot of time. But if you haven't looked at any of those emails in quite some time, just
get rid of them.
Just get rid of them. Don't think about it too much. You could always archive it, but I think that's the same thing. And I can definitely say I'm guilty of this. I will save a copy, whether it's a physical object or something else, put it somewhere just in case I need it. And then it turns out you look 5 years later and, oh, I never needed that. What should my decision be? Probably to get rid of it. So I'd recommend getting rid of it because it may contain data that while it doesn't seem like it should be a concern, you have less knowledge or visibility of it. You have less awareness of it. So if you don't need it, go ahead and get rid of it. It's less risky for you because there's not data sitting out there that could somehow be important.
So get rid of it, Betty. Thank you for calling. Chuck in Prairie du Sac. Hello.
Good morning. I have a pretty quick question, I think. I got a notice from, says Microsoft Windows support, that suspicious activity on my IP address and need to call them to clear it up. Is that legit?
That one definitely sounds like a scam. That one is a pretty common one. One thing you could do if you really did want to contact Microsoft, you can actually find the phone number for Microsoft support on one of Microsoft's websites. My guess it's going to be a different phone number. What I'd recommend doing first is probably downloading and installing a program like Malwarebytes or Super Anti-Spyware, or even if you have an antivirus program on your computer. Scan your whole system just to see what it does find. Usually the pop-ups from your computer are especially with this one, it's kind of a common scam where you'll call somebody and they'll want remote access to clean up your computer. They will actually end up infecting it a little bit more. And you'll have to actually pay for the service where, you know, usually it's, hey, we'll clean up your computer for $60 and you'll be all set. They're really just, they infected your computer to collect the $60. So especially if there's a price tag anywhere on that, I would say it's definitely a scam. And install something like Super Anti-Spyware or Malwarebytes to scan your computer. Otherwise, what you could do, usually contacting Microsoft is going to be a little bit more challenging. You could also bring it into a local computer repair center, any local company that does any kind of computer support could help clean it up. But I would take a look at those free tools because they are freely available. And if it gives you some red flags, you'll at least get a better indication. But it's very, very likely that it is a scam.
Nick just emailed that he was listening. He received an email from UW Credit Union warning him they will never call to ask for a security code he receives from a text, just as an FYI.
Yes. Yeah, that's no one should ever be calling for any kind of authentication information,
yeah.
Whether it is a password code or something else.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick look at the news and weather. Our guest today, Jesse LeGru, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. As I said, we'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGru, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Great to have him on to talk about, well, we've gotten into phones and tablets, smartphones, computers, all kinds of things with him. And I hope you'll join in. Our lines are all filled, and we got lots of emails. So let's go to the phones. And Dave in Salem up next. Dave, hello.
Hi. I was a exclusive Apple user for a really long time, and then when the Google Pixel first came out, I switched over. My wife and I both switched over, and we've been on Android ever since. But since hearing about the privacy issues and all that is concerning about Google. And I remember when I was an Apple user that I also kind of felt privacy issues about Apple, but I'm just from your perspective, I guess. Also, I guess I should also note that I'm a teacher and my school is exclusively Apple. But we use Google products like Google Mail and Google Drive, and all the slides and everything is through Google. So the whole thing is very convoluted. What would you suggest? I do. I'm considering going back to the Apple, but I don't really know.
It's a really, really tough question, actually, because there's no real straightforward way. One thing I'd look, at least for any different service provider, is what are the capabilities they have in their tools to secure my data? Do I know they're sharing it or not sharing it with other individuals or companies or third parties? So it's kind of some general recommendations here, and then I'll kind of dig a little bit deeper. One, always review privacy policies, as boring as they are, because they'll tell you how they're sharing your data. If you are using services, see if they offer enhanced security mechanisms like multi-factor authentication, two-factor authentication. If they don't offer that, lean towards one that does. In this case, both do offer those kinds of services, but that would be an impact for me. In terms of physical devices, so let's say iPhones versus Android phones, the nice thing with Apple phones is they're relatively consistent. Device to device, they're the same. Same thing with the operating system. The one thing that's good to note about the Apple phones, if you are a certain, you know, hardware revision, you may not be able to receive updates. So you might want to make sure you just have a more recent device so you can get the most recent software. Android phones can vary quite a bit, and I think that can offer a lot of complicating factors that could impact security. I think being able to have a consistency with device and the software on it helps to, it could make the device more secure.
Mm-hmm.
What we do with those devices also impacts it as well. Enabling multi-factor authentication using services that we know are secure, and also granting those services or applications only the rights they really need to do what they need to do is important. For example, if I'm using Google Drive doesn't need to access my camera for any reason whatsoever. So if it's asking me to access my camera, I might want to look for a different service or only enable the pieces that it needs. So being careful about how we're using the device is also really important. There's no one great answer. A lot of schools utilize Chromebooks, Google services for a variety of reasons, and they can work really well. It's usually how we utilize the service that actually impacts the security most of all. Do we enable multi-factor authentication? Are we storing data in a consistent manner so we know where things are and how to remove those pieces of information when we need to? But are we also looking at what is the company doing with my data? Am I going to be expected to be part of a marketing company's data aggregation, which means I'm going to get phone calls or emails or all sorts of other stuff all over the place because I'm using those services? So I'd say for consistency, I'd say Apple does have a benefit just because their hardware is consistent. With the Android phones, it gets a lot more complicated. In terms of the other services, it's hard to say. I think for a lot of the collaboration software, you know, Google Drive, Google Docs, they work really, really well. I wouldn't state that there's an Apple service that kind of competes. But in terms of hardware, there are some benefits to having Apple. I use a variety of devices. I've used Apple iOS devices, Android devices, and Windows mobile devices. Whatever works, but hopefully the easier it is to use, the more simplified it is to secure as well. So if I had to go one way, I'd say Apple, but that's with a big asterisk because there's more to it than that. Use best practices, and if the services don't support those best practices like multi-factor authentication, use something else.
There you go, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Amy in Mosinee has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Amy.
Hi. We have two older computers. One's a PC and one's a Mac. And we are no longer interested in using them. Would like to donate them or at the very least recycle them. But we don't know how to get our personal information off easily without going through stats. Is there a program that we can use, or is there a place that we could take it and just have it wiped? I guess we're just with having two different operating systems, it's a little tough to navigate. And like I said, they're both a little on the older side. Would probably work for, you know, games or streaming video or something like that, where somebody could make use of them.
Did you need any data from those computers, or are you just trying to make sure? Okay. Were you concerned whether anyone used those hard drives again themselves, or just to make sure that your data wasn't on there?
As long as our data's not on there, no, we don't. I mean, and it's probably not even anything super important, but you never know. I mean, like, now that we haven't used the computers in so many years that we just... One of them was for my daughter, who's now 21, and it's so old we can't even upgrade it to Windows 10. Like, it didn't come with the free upgrade. And the other one was my husband's old work computer, and that was a Mac. But we obviously don't want to just throw it in the garbage. So
right, for sure,
we can get it somewhere.
Yeah, so there are a couple different ways to go. I would look for any local companies that do kind of data destruction or recycling, and there's a variety of companies out there that will do it so the devices can be reused. Sometimes there are school programs that you can donate computers and they can be reused by somebody who could really use them. For your hard drive itself, you can go so many different ways. Because you can also drop that off to a shredding service. I think even a lot of companies like Staples, they have agreements with companies that do help not only with document shredding, they'll actually help with some electronic disposal as well, such as hard drives. And I know there's at least one in Mosinee that will actually, it's a shredding service. I think it's called Iro. And they could potentially do something like that. They might do it for free. If you just want to make sure your data is not on there, I would look for anyone that knows anything about computers, any kid around the neighborhood, because all you really need is the hard drive and a drill. And if you drill through the hard drive and break up the platters, you're most likely going to be able to ruin any data and make it unrecoverable from anyone who wants to try to get into the systems. Because I'm guessing they're older and they probably have platters that you can drill through. A drill press is really the cheapest way because most people, somebody is going to have a drill somewhere. All you need to do is get the hard drive out. But if you did want to go through and make sure somebody could reuse a device, I would check with local recycling companies because one, they can help dispose or destroy the data, but they also might be able to inform you how they use those devices because, you know, there are a lot of individuals that may not have access to technology that could be something they could easily use. Even if it's something you're not going to. So I would check out local recycling services and see what they have to say.
And thanks for calling, Amy. Joey in Madison emailed to say he has a big house and wondering what's the best way to get Wi-Fi throughout the entire building.
There's a variety of ways. There are a lot of what they call like mesh networking devices. And there are a lot of them out there. Some of them are more or less easy to use. But as soon as you have an internet connection somewhere in the house, you can have wireless systems where you can deploy multiple wireless access points and they will work together to offer coverage for your entire house. Some are more or less sophisticated than others, but usually if you look for like wireless mesh or probably not distributed wireless, but for larger spaces, there are some really good products out there that can actually make it really, really easy. So when you add a new access point, it joins the existing network and it extends it. So first it's available in your one corner of your house, then it's available in the other corner, then you can extend it upstairs, and you can do it so you can actually kind of see what that looks like. But you can look from a variety of services, and there are stores that probably sell them in the store, and you can also look online. But you're looking for something to kind of create an extended wireless or mesh wireless network.
Let's go to Kate in Elm Grove. Hi, Kate.
Hi there. I was wondering, and I don't even know if these still exist, but at one time you could use something called a password safe where you would enter all your passwords into the software.
Yep.
And then you had one master password for that software. It was the only thing you had to remember.
And actually, in that name alone, password safe is a password manager that you can use on a local computer that you can do exactly as you described. Password safe is a completely free application, but there are also ones that you can install and access from the general internet. So Dashlane, 1Password, LastPass, there are a lot of products out there, and most of them offer a free consumer version that you don't have to pay for, that you can put all your passwords in. It even has plugins for browsers or applications for your smartphone that allow you to connect all your devices. So it can be very simple where you kind of have one local vault to access, or you can have it so you can even access it remotely. So there's a lot of options out there depending on what you're looking for.
Thank you, Kate. Appreciate it. Tom in Buffalo County, sorry.
Yes. Hello, fellas.
Hi.
Hi. I can't register an Microsoft account on my Windows 10, you know, for recovering passwords, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
It says my email address is an EDU account or something else, and it's just not there. It won't, and I can't find any way to register my email there.
Hmm. Is your email account a .edu account?
No. It's a .net account.
Okay. So there's a few things I would take a look at. Are you trying to access and create the account directly through like the Windows interface, or are you using a web browser?
I'm just going through the Windows interface where you sign in on your computer.
Okay. What you might want to do, is this a brand new computer?
Well, it's a Windows 10. I mean, I've had it for 2 years.
Okay. One thing you might want to take a look at first is go to kind of a generic Microsoft account sign-in location. So if you just go to Microsoft.com, you can actually try to create an account there just directly on the web to see if you get the same or a similar message. Usually the web interface is going to give you more options. You might be able to create an account for Microsoft there, because usually they'll have one of two options: kind of create a brand new account without any previous email address, or create an account based on one you already have, which in this case is your .NET account. I would try to do it on the web first, then try to reuse that within the Windows interface, but you're probably going to get some more feedback from the web interface in terms of trying to create an account and what some of those roadblocks are. One of the things that, you know, we might see at an educational institution, we might have Microsoft services as an institution, so you might not be able to create an account using that email address because you kind of already have one. That could be a possibility for your address as well. Maybe it came with a different service and you actually have a different kind of an account already out there that you can use rather than trying to recreate. But I would take a look at the Microsoft account page first, because I think it's going to give you better feedback in terms of what the roadblocks are.
And thanks for calling, Tom. Appreciate it. Cheyenne in Green Bay, your turn now. Hi, Cheyenne.
Hi. I have a question about a Windows Vista that was set up by a computer technician in 2009. In 2013, this computer technician provided me with an email account that was not an email account set up by my internet provider. It was the second one. And this computer technician also was my antivirus provider. I paid him a yearly fee for that. In 2014, I discovered that this person, I don't know if it was a person or not, but this is what I'm asking you, your opinion on this. I discovered that I had Video Conference Manager running in the background on my computer, and my password was, my secured password for my Wi-Fi was hacked into, and my Wi-Fi was vulnerable then. My question for you is if this person had a dedicated line, because he does have websites, although I did not have a website through him, is it possible to track where that video conference manager was going?
It is possible. It might be. There's a lot of complicating factors there. Depending on your internet service provider, they might have information that can help track down where those communication pieces are. For most home networks, you probably don't have enough local audit logs to really see what applications were trying to communicate somewhere else on the internet. Windows Vista or other Windows systems may have local firewall logs that could tell you what the computer is communicating with, but it wouldn't tell you what that conference manager application was communicating with. So you're probably only going to be able to find out what your computer was talking to, but you're not necessarily going to know what that conference manager app was talking to, at least in the past. Now, if you're looking for what might it try to talk to in the future, there are ways to try to track that down. For most of that, I'd probably recommend reaching out to kind of a computer service to take a look, because the built-in Windows programs, at least for the firewall, won't tell you that. There are other tools on there that will, but you need experience with the tools in order to use them. They're not very user-friendly. So you might actually have to purchase a third-party app to actually even tell you. So there's going to be limited information about what you can find out in the past. One thing you might want to take a look in terms of the video conference manager, because it sounds like you don't know where it came from or what it's doing, look in programs and services. It's usually add or remove programs in the control panel. It will usually tell you when it was last installed and when it was last used. So at least you can get an indication of when that computer program showed up on your computer, which might give you an indication about how it popped onto your computer. You can also get some computer services to take a look and get a better indication as well, because there could be computer logs specifically for that application itself that you could unpack. So I would look in add or remove programs to find out when it arrived. It might tell you or give you an indication about how it got there. But I'd also take a look at your program files folder, because it will probably have a location for that computer program, which probably has a date and a time on the folder when it was created. So it could give you an indication there. But I'd actually reach out to somebody that kind of specializes in taking a look at those types of computer forensics details and digging in a little bit. Anyone who's used to looking at malware might also be able to do that, and local services would be very useful for it.
Thank you, Cheyenne. Appreciate it. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Janice in Grafton. Hi.
This might be a strange question, but I don't know if there's an answer for it. I unfortunately have probably 1,000 or more emails, and I'm wondering, is there a quick way that I can get rid of them and delete them, spam them, whatever, other than just individual?
Mm-hmm. That is a great question. Part of me would almost, it can be tricky. Do you use a web interface to access your email currently?
Well, yes, but I don't seem to have a lot of time to get on and do those things religiously every day like one should. And I have some investment things, and I don't want to delete everything, but I just want to delete and also block some things too.
Okay. One item you might want to take a look at, you can, it's really going to depend on the service here, and that's where it's going to get tricky. What email service do you currently use?
Well, I have some AOL, and also, but I'm not real crazy about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also Microsoft.
Yeah. Okay. Some of them will allow you to select all your email and hit delete. The downside, it usually will only delete the emails that you can currently see on the screen. So if it shows 50 emails, you'll only delete emails 50 emails at a time. If you are utilizing an email application like Outlook or the Mail app or Thunderbird, there are a lot of options out there. Many of those applications will allow you to download all your emails and delete all your emails.
Yeah.
So I'd probably recommend installing one of those applications to read your to download all that content, then delete all of it and empty all of your trash. It's going to be a little specific to the email provider that you're using. The first recommendation that actually came to mind was simply delete your email account and then wait a day and recreate it if you can. In some ways it's probably easier depending on what you have to do. Some services allow you to just delete all your email, but they kind of make it a little bit painful for others. So using a third-party program that gets set up and delete is hopefully going to be a little bit easier.
And thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it. And Jesse, thank you so much. You're going to be back January 13th. We'll do it all over again.
Sounds great.
Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Tomorrow, Bonnie Olson, the public address voice of the UW women's sports teams, joins us. And then we'll look at efforts to build a baseball field and conference that allows all children to play. Stay with us. In the meantime, lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller.